Hello, everyone. Bridget here, your resident Dear Vampire Diaries podcast host. I'm here with a special guest, Dr. Kendra R. Parker, who is a professor of African American literature at Georgia Southern University. Her upcoming projects include a book on understanding Octavia E. Butler with the University of South Carolina Press, which is slated for spring 2025. And she's also contributing a piece on the final Blacks in the TBD franchise for our friend of the pod, Deanna Koretsky, which is for the edited collection tentatively titled Demystifying Mystic Falls, Race and Racism in the Vampire Diaries Universe, which is how we met through Deanna. Thank you so much, Dr. Parker, for being here.
Yes.
I feel very honored.
No, thank you. I'm super excited to talk about Vampire Diaries and everything related to it.
Hell yes. When I first talked to Deanna, she was like, oh my gosh, like one of the first submissions I got was from Dr. Kendra Parker, who was amazing. She was like, I should totally hook you up with her. And she fangirled about you so hardcore. And then I started looking up, like I listened to, I think you were on Fresh Air talking about Octavia E. Butler, which is really cool. And like, aww. I read your book, She Bites Back, which is amazing.
Thank you.
And yeah, I'm very honored that you made time to talk about this. And,
oh,
yeah.
No, absolutely. It's the funny story about that submission I sent to her, because I was preparing to go to California for an archival research trip on my book on Butler. And I saw the call for papers and I was like, you have something else to do. You can't do this. And I was talking to my friends and I was like, oh my gosh, y'all won't believe this. There's a CFP. I was describing it. And they were just like, so what's the problem? Why don't you do it? And I said, no, you're supposed to tell me to focus on my focus. And I said, but I mean, I already have an abstract in mind. And so I think 3 days later, I sent it. And then I got her email. I sent it to her. And then it was like Mother's Day weekend. I got back to my place and a friend of mine, she was like, hey, I saw this call for papers and I thought about you. And I was like, I already submitted an abstract.
Yes, that was the sign. I love that.
Yeah,
this is amazing. I have some like general questions to ask you, which are kind of like I ask everyone, and then we can get into more specific stuff because we have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely.
Do you want to just tell me a little bit about how you started first watching The Vampire Diaries?
Yes. It's actually a funny story. Like, so I heard about it through a college friend of mine. So it was actually my first year of graduate school. And she landed sort of an internship type gig as a makeup artist apprentice for this TV show. And she called me. She was like, oh, this one actor, he's got really pretty eyes. And I was like, okay. And I was like, and she was like, I'm learning a lot. She's like, oh, he's just so gorgeous. And that was it. And so 4 years later, it was in 2012, I actually got really sick. And so I binged watched the first four seasons, I think, on Netflix. And
as a literal fever dream.
Yes. Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. And of course, I had to agree with her, like at the very end, because I saw Stefan and I was like, oh, okay. Like his eyes aren't remarkable or whatever. But then at the end of the episode where this guy pops up and he's like, well, hello, brother. I said, that's the guy. I said, okay, he's nice looking on the eyes for sure. So yeah, that's how I got started.
That's amazing. And then you've seen more than I have, because I think you've seen all of the originals as well as legacies, right?
Yes, that is correct.
It's amazing. Oh, yeah. And I should say to everyone, this is a spoiler inclusive episode. So if you really do not want spoilers, go watch the show and then come back and listen to this.
Yes.
But you know more than I do, which is totally fine. Please don't worry about spoiling things for me, because I'm all about the journey. And like, you know, knowing stuff doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, perfect. I don't know if I make any major spoilers, but they're just things it might be a spoiler for somebody. I'm just like, oh.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No. Feel free to reference all of it.
Okay.
Did you have anyone that watched it with you, or were you mostly a solitary, sickly audience?
It was mostly solitary. So I don't even think I can say this. I don't even think it was my Netflix account.
Yeah.
I didn't have Netflix at the time. But I think the one person who was watching it before I did, Dr. Atkins, she was watching it, but we didn't watch it together. We would watch and talk about other things like Hunger Games, Divergent, Grimm.
Yeah.
But that was something sort of floating in the background. But no, it was a solitary experience. We're talking about it now, though.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, she's rewatching it and things like that. But no, it was really a solitary experience.
Yeah. It's interesting to then be able to like talk to other people about it after you have your experience with it, which is kind of what has been the joy of this podcast for me, certainly.
Nice.
Do you enjoy other vampire media? I know the answer to this, but do you enjoy other vampire media other than TBD?
I do, and there's so many, like, too many to name. So, like, the obvious Blackula and Scream, Blackula, Scream, Vampire in Brooklyn and Blade, but Grace Jones is Vamp, which, not a lot of people know about. I really enjoyed the movie Vampires versus the Bronx, to the point where when it first came out on Netflix, my sister was hosting all of my nephews at her house for Halloween. She was like, I need a movie night. And I said, oh, Vampires versus the Bronx. And they started casting each other as different characters. And I was like, y'all are ridiculous.
I love that. I love that.
Also, the new Interview the Vampire,
Oh
I really
yeah.
like that. I
Oh
have only
yes.
watched the first season.
Me too.
I
Yeah.
haven't, okay, so I haven't started the second season, but I really enjoyed that. I thought it was really well done. And of course, I've seen the Twilight series. I don't
Yeah,
feel
yeah.
like I was very resistant to watching that when I was doing my dissertation.
Yeah.
Somebody was like, but if you're writing about vampires, you have to do Twilight.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I don't, in my head. And I didn't have to,
No, yeah.
but I did start. I think I saw one of the movies when I was at my parents' house for spring break. I saw the very end of the second movie,
Yeah,
and he
part
was just
two.
like, will you, yeah, it was like, will you marry me? And then it was the end, and I was like, wait, what? And then I saw the third movie. I was like, oh, this is actually kind of good. So I went back and watched the first one. I was like, okay, not the greatest,
Right.
but they get better. And then I
They
did read
do.
the books. Yeah. And I remember, like, I know the books got a lot of flack. I mean, aside from Stephanie Meyer's politics and all of that,
Yes.
like, I just remember reading it and I was like, I don't know. Like, I could see a tween girl me really getting
Totally.
into this. Like, so I was like, no, I could see the appeal for it.
Yeah, heck yeah. Oh boy, this is such a loaded next question, and we're gonna it's I almost feel bad asking you like such a general question when you've written so much on the topic. But what
Uh-oh.
are your feelings about vampires in the zeitgeist? Sorry.
And so when you say zeitgeist, you mean like
Like the
as they
times.
recur over
Yeah,
time?
exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I know people were very upset with Twilight, like with all the sparkly vampires, but I also think that, vampires, they certainly have their purpose. And if we go back to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and actually LJ Smith's novels
Yeah.
on the Vampire Diaries, the vampire shifted from being this predatory type of being to very sympathetic.
Right.
And we can even take that back a little bit further with Blackula, right?
Yeah,
If we
yeah.
look at that 1972 film, I mean, there's I ask my students to think of him as a tragic hero because he is a very sympathetic character. I think we're supposed to sympathize with him. And so it's interesting to see it in that way. And then of course, in my book I talk about what happens when Black women are characterized as predators, as
Yeah.
vampiric. And so it really depends on, there's this interesting thing about thinking about vampire, like the vampire is the other is a problem, depending on who's in power, right?
Yes.
Or depending on perspective. So, I think in my book I write about, Ronald Reagan referring to, Black women as, welfare queens, and that
Right.
gets coded into this
Blood
bloodsucker
suckers.
stereotype. Yeah. So you've got that. But then on the reverse, you're like, well, what about the policies and things that Reagan dismantled? So
Yes.
from the perspective of those who are historically minoritized, he's the vampire. And
Right.
so there's this idea of, it depends on perspective, but often who's in power gets to determine who's the bad predator, if you will.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite things. I'm like, I marked some of your book so that I could read a little bit. I love, so in Kendra's book, She Bites Back, you call the afterword the final bite, which is hilarious.
I do.
I just want to read this. This is on page 113. You wrote, Black female vampires continue into the 21st century as important literary figures and as revealing indicators of cultural attitudes and trends about African American women's bodies. African American women in the United States will always be targeted for their corporeal power that supports the visual entertainment industry. Therefore, it's important to encourage the up-and-coming generations to learn about their representations and how to navigate systems designed to exploit them, especially since the images of the vampire continue to proliferate in the present moment, perhaps more so than ever before. Which was like, I was like, that is so well written
Well, you
and so on point, and I think relates a lot to what you just spoke to about like power and casting people in different power, and like we're gonna get into some conversations about like specifically Bonnie in the TBDU and like her power, which is so associated with like her physical presence and like and also how it's taken away from her and like exploited. It's like so it's such a weird. Yeah, there's like so many contradictions involved. And I just feel like you really articulated that like so well in this book.
Oh, thank you.
And I can't wait to read. I can't wait to read more of your work. I'm so excited. I'm going to be like the first one to be buying like Demystifying Mystic Falls.
Look, I can't wait for that book either. And I have to say, it's so weird to, have my work read. I'm like, oh, I wrote that?
I bet you're a little bit like, oh, you just real lifed me.
Like, yeah, I'm just like, oh, wow, I'm smart, you know?
Yes!
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite vampire character? Obviously does not have to be from The Vampire Diaries.
You know, this is funny. So I teach a course on Black vampires, and when I have my students introduce themselves, either in class or on the discussion board, I have them like, what's your favorite or least favorite vampire? And I participate with them.
Yes.
And I'm just like, yeah, so I feel bad for asking this question because I'm going to cheat. Because my answer is always whichever vampire I'm reading or watching at the moment.
Yes.
So since I'm currently writing this piece for Demystifying Mystic Falls, I have been, you know, knee deep in Vampire Diaries Legacies and the original. So my favorite vampire of the moment would be Marcel.
Yes!
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Marcellus.
We're going to have you back to talk about the originals, like specifically.
Oh, that's it.
Which, I know. Whew. This is a similar question to the Zeitgeist, but I guess if you think that we can learn from vampires as an archetype, what do you think they can teach us?
So much. I think so much. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to teach the class. I was an English major in college and I'd never had a class on Black vampires, but I really loved the African-American literature courses that I took. Shout out to Dr. Stacy Boyd at the University of West Georgia, because like he was the first, you know, Black professor that I had in college. And so I took every class he offered because I just wanted to learn more. And so, you know, I like reading about the supernatural, and I realized that, you know, sometimes we want to read something different. We don't necessarily like, let's read something. And so I wanted to teach this Black vampire course because I was thinking about something that Rudine Sims Bishop wrote, that books are windows, mirrors, or sliding glass doors. And I do actually, I have that quote pulled up if I can read it.
Yeah.
Okay. So she writes that books are sometimes windows, offering views of the world that may be real or imagined, familiar or strange. These windows are also sliding glass doors, and readers have only to walk through an imagination to become part of whatever world has been created or recreated by the author. When lighting conditions are just right, however, a window can also be a mirror. Literature transforms human experience and reflects it back to us. And in that reflection, we can see our own lives and experiences as part of the larger human experience.
Beautiful.
And so I wanted to teach a Black vampires course because I teach at a PWI. And so I wanted any Black student who took that class to see some of their experiences reflected back at them. And often, you know, vampires are considered predatory, but when I look at Black vampires in Black authored work, they're multifaceted. They're both the villain and the hero. They're, you know, they're the person you root for, the person you hate. And I really like that. But also, you know, I teach this one story called The Ultimate Diet. And, you know, the person is a fat Black woman. And she's like, have you ever seen a fat vampire? Like, she's really concerned with her body, right? And she becomes a vampire and becomes skinny. But we talk about body dysmorphia. And then so how we see her shift. And so there's things like that. Like we sparkle, and it's not all about finding your love interest. It's about dealing with some topics that I think are really important. I like teaching K. Murray Johnson's A Slave's Tale. It's actually an embedded story in his novel that's a lot longer.
Wow.
Because it's about a gay Black vampire.
Amazing.
And so, you know, to have a love interest and all of those things, like, it's not something that we often see. Like if we think about TVDU, we know queer characters don't survive. Right. I think we've got one in the originals who survives, and then the other duo that would have survived, one of them gets killed off, and none of them are vampires and none of them are Black. I take that back. One of the duo, one person is Black, the other is white. But you know, that's a problem in and of itself. How the Black character gets with the white character. She's a victim of Stockholm Syndrome.
Oh, wow.
In that particular, you know, in the way I read that. Yes. And so I'm not entirely sure that answers your question, but it's this idea that I think vampires as an archetype, when we think about the archetype, we often think of the tall, skinny, attractive white male. And I think that can be a problem. And they're often economically privileged, right? Like that's the benefit
Yes.
of being the vampire, right? You've lived a long time, you've got a
Right.
lot of money, you don't ever see a poor vampire, like you're making really bad
Yes.
financial decisions. But it's also just really nice to sort of complicate matters, like
Yeah.
complicate that a little bit more. Like, what does it mean when, can you have fat vampires? I remember in
Right.
True Blood, the TV show, I forget Sookie Stackhouse's brother's name,
Oh,
but
Jason, I think.
Jason,
Yeah.
okay, he's at this the house of this gay vampire, and he's fat. And Jason's like, "Well, why are you fat?" And he's like, "Well, contrary to popular belief, when you become a vampire, you stay exactly the way you are." And he was like, "Oh, I never thought about that." But so I like that sort of disruption of the vampire. So I mean,
Yes.
I think what we can learn from vampires is to like dismantle the archetype and look at them from multiple
Yeah.
perspectives, because I think that's where stuff gets really interesting.
I love that. I love how multifaceted that answer is, because in the back, in the final bite, you talk about the skepticism that you've received in teaching this and people being like, "What's the point?" And like, I don't even teach this. I just have a podcast, and people are like, "Oh, so your podcast is about pop culture that doesn't matter?" And I'm like, "Excuse me."
It does matter,
It
though.
does matter,
It matters a
exactly.
lot. Yeah.
It matters a lot, and I feel like that answer is great, because you're like, yeah, let me just like boom, 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 boom. Here are so many things that we can learn. And I love that you touched on, like, especially like fat phobia is very related to racism, which is something I've learned in like recent years, and the like white supremacy of what bodies we consider to have a moral hierarchy. And we definitely see that on the CW. I mean, in all media. But certainly on the CW, there are no fat characters. I don't think there's even any really average bodies, you know?
Not at all.
Yeah, they're all very like model-esque, very thin.
Very
Yeah, there's a
muscly,
lot to
very,
be said.
conventionally attractive, just, yeah, I'm sort of going through like trying to think if there's not a one.
No,
Not a one.
yeah. Yeah, and that's very classic for the CW, but for media in general, and really interesting to link it to vampires as well, because there is like this weird superiority of like, oh, they're faster, stronger, blah blah blah. And because of our, sort of inherent biases about this, we're like, and they're thin.
They've got this sort of ideal, quote unquote, ideal body.
Right, the thin ideal. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's I love that you touched on that. I'm gonna need like a running list of all of the. I'm gonna be listening to this, like trying to write down everything that you've referenced so I can put it in the show notes so that people can like look it up. Because I want to read
I'll
that
give you
now,
my
The Ultimate Diet.
bibliography. No.
Perfect. Oh my God, thank you. Well, we already touched on this about why it's important to talk about race and vampires, but maybe we can drive the point home a little bit. I was reading Ebony Elizabeth Thomas's book, The Dark Fantastic. She's got a whole chapter in there on Bonnie, which is awesome, and someone
Yes.
like Gwen from Merlin, and like, oh my God, like Rue from The Hunger Games, and like, fantastic book.
So good, so good.
What she said was, race matters in the real world and it matters in fiction. And I felt like that was the most succinct way of putting it.
I mean, yeah, and vampires too, they've long been connected to different forms of othering just beyond race. And if we think about Count Dracula, like if anybody thinks, they're thinking about that, but a number of scholars have analyzed how Stoker's characterization of the Count was a representation of some of these anxieties in late 19th century England. Like they were concerned about sexuality, gender, immigration, the unstable economy. So yeah, like, and I also think it's important too, because the skepticism, but I always have somebody when I first started, going on the job market and things like that. I'm like, oh, writing about black vampires, or if I'm teaching the class, and sometimes people are like, oh, I didn't know they had those. And I'm always curious about like who the they is, right? Like who's the they? But like I get it, you're just like, oh, because like I didn't know there were black vampires. Yeah, well, there are.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Oh my gosh. Amazing. Well, it's interesting because when we look at like, especially because you wrote so beautifully about these black female vampires as authored by African American women, we have something very different when we look at the Vampire Diaries universe, because the showrunners are white. It's so pervasive, and like we get a very tokenized character out of Bonnie, who's portrayed brilliantly by Cat Graham, but struggles with a lot of these like very limiting storylines, or like she gets sort of like shunted into these weird tropes, like the magical Negro trope. And, you know, there are a lot of things I want to talk to you about with that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm jumping around. I'm like, okay, I had never heard of the Sisterella complex before reading She Bites Back. I think you talk about it in terms of Mary from, is it Mind of My Mind?
Yes.
Yes. So, okay. So the Sisterella complex, let's see. I also have a page for this in case listeners also don't know. So in here you quoted Shifting, The Double Lives of Black Women in America by Cherise Jones and Kumeya Shorter Gooden. And it defines the Sisterella complex as, much like the classic Cinderella character, Sisterella is the black woman who honors others but denies herself. She achieves in her own right, indeed she may overachieve, yet she works tirelessly, sometimes masochistically, to promote, protect, and appease others. She is trying so hard to be what others want and need that she has lost control of the shifting process. It's overtaken her. She's lost sight of her own gifts as well as her own needs. Her identity is confused, and her personal goals are deeply buried. She shrinks inwardly. She becomes depressed, sometimes severely so. And I read that and went, oh my God, Bonnie.
Absolutely. I mean, it's Bonnie time and again throughout the Vampire Diaries universe. There are certainly moments where she does resist, and she tries to resist, but almost always at her expense or at the expense of somebody she loves. But, you know, another thing that they say, it's actually on page 124, is that they say that they're pushed insidiously, unwittingly, often invisibly toward depression. And, you know, I think we see that in so many ways with Bonnie, not just because of how she's treated, but because of the lack of community that she has around her.
So true. And like, looking at like, gosh, there are all of these moments of like potential for connection that make me so excited. Like Grams, I love when Grams is around. Jasmine Guy is amazing. She should have been a series regular if they could have just kept Grams
alive.
And yeah, alive. and then of course we lose her, which is kind of, you know, I mean, I think it's in service to like, they're doing a spell just not even for like Elena's survival. I think it's to get Stefan out of a tomb or something. Mm-hmm. And he's a vampire. Mm-hmm. He could survive. Mm-hmm. It's just so he doesn't even just get trapped underground. And that's the cause that we lose Grams to. It's like always Bonnie's Sisterella seems always like complex, always seems tied to Elena's well-being and her love interests. And it's like the writers tried to make Elena Bonnie's world. And it's so problematic. It's not like you can't have, you know, a white friend. It's just she has no family.
No family. No family, no friends. And this is something we briefly talked about. You brought it to my attention that, like, Bonnie doesn't have a home in the same way.
There's no set. Where's the Bennett set?
Yes. Like, there's, like, we don't get to see the inside of her house. And when you mention that, when we were first talking, it's not something that I'd actually thought about. And I thought about it some more. And of course, initially it made me think about, well, part of it is just this dynamic between Katerina Petrova and her relationship with Emily Bennett, sort of reproducing that master-slave dynamic.
Right.
And it makes Bonnie tethered to Elena and Caroline to a degree. But as I kept thinking about it some more, I started to think about, you know, part of it is also this home as an archival space. And so if we think about the home as an archival space, this absence of a home for Bonnie or a home set for Bonnie becomes really, I mean, it's already problematic, but it becomes even more so problematic because the absence of her home set, it sort of speaks to a larger belief about whether Black people have archival histories worth documenting. In 2018, Ashley D. Farmer, who is an award-winning historian, she explored what it actually means to be Black in the archives in her essay, Archiving While Black, written for the African American Intellectual History Society. And in that essay, one of the things she does is she talks about John Hope Franklin, a noted historian, and she talks about the resistance, surprise, and the skepticism that he actually got when he was trying to access historical materials in the archives, because the underlying assumptions from the white people that he encountered were that, one, Black people weren't intelligent enough to even access the archives or advance study, and two, that Black people didn't have a history worth archiving, right? And so while we might not typically think of someone's home as an archival space, it really is, like, you know, when I, at least when I think about it, right? So you've got homes have photos and photo albums. They've got family heirlooms, like whether it's furniture, jewelry, or clothing, and even like traditional archival materials, their letters, like date of birth things, birth certificates, wedding certificates, obituaries, books people collected. And so when somebody passes away, right, you often go through those belongings, you find a treasure trove of things. And so those are archives. And so the absence of Bonnie's home speaks to that larger sense that John Hope Franklin experienced, the one that Dr. Farmer actually writes about, the idea that there's an assumption in the TVD imagination, that Black people don't have memories, materials, or spaces that are useful or intriguing or worth exploring. And, you know, specifically
outside of where it serves like the white protagonist storyline.
Yes.
It's like, oh, we'll have you show up in these flashbacks in 1864. Oh, we'll have your family show up here when we magically need another witch to unspell this coffin.
But not just to see like, hey, you have a past, something that matters. And so Bonnie is rootless. Well, it functions to position Bonnie as rootless. We know she's not. And that's actually one of the reasons I love, I think it's the final season, the final episode of season 8, where Bonnie essentially saves Mystic Falls. I love the scene where all of her ancestors come back and they visibly appear on the screen and they're like touching her shoulder and they're connected because, like, for me, it's not about the fact that she saves the town. Yay, great, woohoo, whatever. But it's, for me, it's sort of, it lets her know that she's not alone. And we've known all along that she's not alone. But also, it reminds me, reminds viewers that she is connected to something much larger, much browner than what she's been, than what she's been connected to. And it translates visually in a way that I think was important on screen for viewers. So I really, really love that moment. But that whole question when you were like, I was thinking about it. I was like, the absence of a home space certainly is connected to that master slave dynamic, but it speaks to something I think deeper and more insidious.
Yes. And we get it for so many of the side characters. Like, we get Matt's home, you know, we don't go there a ton, but he does get, you know, like scenes in his home. We understand that he lives differently than Elena lives, you know,
his sister.
We certainly get, his sister. Yeah. We get so many things and like his family is killed off early, but we at least get his home life and we get little glimpses of it. And we really don't for Bonnie. I think maybe the first time she gets a set is season 4 or 5. Like,
and that's when, like, we meet her dad for the first
time. Right, like, for the first time.
Isn't he like the town mayor or something? And I was like, that's where have you random. Been, dude?
And they mention him, like, what an interesting, this is what bugs me about the Vampire Diaries, is that I know they know how to write. I know they can write well. I know they're capable of it because they do it for other characters.
They do.
There were all these threads to tug on. Like, they talk about, you know, in the very first scene where we get Bonnie talking to Elena, she's like, oh, Graham's is going on about this, and like, dad doesn't like it. So she's setting up these points of view of like the matriarch of her family, and then whoever her mom married, whatever his perspective is, you know, on this whole thing. That's fascinating. To get those different viewpoints in the home is like, that informs Bonnie and the two sides of herself that war with this. And so it's like, and we don't, there's nothing there that's fleshed out
at all.
And that's such a missed opportunity. It makes me really mad because the show could be better. And I think it was Janelle Gray who said this to me the other day. She said it was in season 2 when she realized, oh, this show isn't for me. She was watching, which is like such a bummer, because when I look back at myself and, you know, I'm, you know, this like little white teenager watching it, I didn't have to think about that stuff, you know, and it's not until a rewatch maybe 10 years later that I'm going, oh, this is like really insidious. And the fact that it didn't interrupt my watching of it, ooh, like that's, it gives me ick. It gives me ick.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting too, because as much as we may be like, oh, it's not for us, there is also some enjoyment. Like, I still found myself invested in the characters, even not just like, I mean, I was Team Bonnie all the time, but you're also still just like, okay, oh, okay, Elena, you're gonna die. Okay, is Elena a vampire? Oh, Damon, I'm gonna get rescued. Oh, Enzo, all these characters, like, oh, is she gonna get stuck in the prison world? Like, and you're sort of rooting for you know, you're like, okay, I'm rooting for Bonnie, but you kind of find yourself, I think I talk about it something similar when I write about Twilight. You were sort of seduced with the narrative to want to
Yes.
side with the dominant white characters. So the
Right.
Salvatores, the Gilberts, and then eventually the Michelsons, right? Like we're sort of
Yes.
seduced to sort of want their outcome to be the best outcome possible. But then,
Right.
you know, there's you're like, but Bonnie's getting nosebleeds left and right trying to help y'all.
That's right, exactly. Yes,
Like,
back to that sisterella complex of like
yeah.
she's such a source of power and yet is so sapped. And I don't understand, like, because, you know, the folks that I've talked to that are women of color that have watched this show that have been invested, it's like, why would the showrunners assume then that young white teenagers, who they were obviously marketing to and very successfully, wouldn't have enjoyed it more if Bonnie had had, like, a really blooming, full, like, personhood on the show? I
Yeah.
don't understand where that comes from, and I think that they shoot themselves in the foot, you know, in not fleshing her out and in not giving her, not letting her take flight, because there's so much there.
Yeah, a lot, so much.
I wanted to ask you about the heroine's journey, because you mentioned that Murdoch's whole thing, and that there's a lot to be said for like Bonnie following that in a lot of ways, and like I wonder if you can read her as like a superhero or as like a heroine in that context, or like what you have to speak to on that.
Yeah, so I definitely think Bonnie saves herself a lot. So I would certainly call her a hero. I'll be honest, I didn't go back and think through her through Murdoch's heroine's journey because it's complicated.
Yeah, and doesn't she say it's
It's
like spiralic? It's like
yeah,
it's you can be
it's
in different phases at once. It's
yeah.
never linear.
So I was like,
Yeah.
but certainly I do think that, you know, while Bonnie is, I think she's rescued once. When she's trapped in the prison world and, you know, she like gets Damon out, he's trying to get her out. She decides to die by suicide. Jeremy actually saves her by opening up the garage. I forget how that works, but then she gets out because Damon finds the clue and plants it so she can find it. And so I think that's probably like, I love that season because
Yeah.
I was hoping that her and Damon would get together. I was like,
Me
yo,
too.
that'd be great. I
Yeah.
would sort of love that.
Yes.
He's disgusting and a jerk, but okay, like I can make that work. And so I was hoping for that. It seemed, you know, it seems like they were building toward it. And you know, we really get to see Bonnie go through it. And I think that for me is the one time where I think they save her just to save her, not because they need her for something. And like so, but yes, I'd say Bonnie is a hero. She saves everybody. Right, she saves everybody and herself, and so she is absolutely a hero, superhero, of course, with her powers. And I think even when she doesn't have her powers, even when she's deceased, well, she's deceased, but she's there, but she's on the other side, like she's still working from the other side as an anchor, trying to in service to whiteness. So yeah, she's absolutely a hero in terms of being very selfless. Ugh, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because you talk about this care ethic in I think it's in Mind of My Mind. But like and like the care ethic here is like it's so not in service to her at all. Like
At
there is no
all.
reciprocity.
None.
And it's just I don't know. I wanted to ask about like it's tough to hold both the sense of like I love so much of Bonnie and yet it's so baked in a lot of these like you know the showrunners having a lot of like white anxiety stuff around like her power and where they
Yeah.
didn't allow her to go, and so it's
Yeah.
a weird thing to it's like cognitive dissonance I guess to kind of hold both because like Bonnie is this amazing character that I feel like I've learned a lot from and that I love watching, and yet you can't divorce it from where she was limited by the fact that this was birthed by like a very white perspective and that there's so much white supremacy in, you know, where the boundaries ended up being for her.
Yeah. Especially with her ending, right? You know, she's, I'm gonna go, you know, travel the world because Enzo wanted me to. Okay, what about your grams though? Like other people, you know, and that I think that hurt the most, because there were so many moments. I was, you know, there were like, I think the Jeremy love interest thing, I was like, whatever, I guess. You know, there were so many others, but you know, Enzo, I was like, ooh, they got together. I was like, okay. I was like, all right, like I can, okay, this is cool and it's working out. And he's trying to keep her alive and do all of this. And then Stefan just rips his heart out. Like, and I was just like, oh, wow. And I mean, she's been through so much. And I'm just like, and yet and still, like, you're responsible for her Graham's death. You're responsible for her lover's death. Like, there's, like Bonnie literally can't win.
No.
And, you know, that goes even, I mean, even if we're not talking about, like, romantic partnerships, but Luca Martin and his dad, Dr. Martin, like, I was so disappointed. First of all, very superficial, but Brighton McClure, who plays Luca, is just so attractive. He's so cute. Absolutely. I remember him from Richie, from Family Matters back in the day.
Amazing.
And I was excited because, you know, he was like flirting with her. Yes, he was trying to like learn about her, but I was like, okay, maybe a little romantic fling. It was so good. I was, and then he, you know, he's killed. And I was like, wow. Okay. You know, I do appreciate that his dad did return Bonnie her powers. And I guess that moment where he gives her powers back, it was rooted in this understanding that Dr. Martin did have Bonnie's best interest at heart. But he was also torn just like her. He was trying to get his own daughter back from Klaus. And so he was, you know, it's so interesting because a lot of the times when the Black characters try to look out for their own families in the same way that the Michelsons do or the Gilberts or the Salvatores, it doesn't end in their best interest, right? You know, you know, the Michelsons, they have this always and forever. That's their quote, family is everything, always and forever. Right. And okay, that's real cute in the Fast and the Furious because it seems to work out for a lot of people in Fast and the Furious, but it doesn't necessarily seem to work out in the Vampire Diaries. Like, always and forever is only when it benefits whiteness. And
absolutely,
you know, so like, while I think Dr. Martin and his son were complicated, I think they were doing what the Michelsons do, what the Salvatores do. They're trying to look out for their own. And everybody ends up dying. I mean, Luca, his sister, and his dad. Like, no, it's,
and so unceremoniously, with no real consequences to the fact that it happened or like ripple effects down the line
at all.
Yeah, at all. It's interesting because Dr. Martin, that whole episode was so deeply rooted in like the angry Black man stereotype with him, like, because his rage, like and of course his rage because his son was killed. But like when they talk about, I think Bonnie says something to them after the fact where she says, "You didn't have to kill him." And Catherine says, "Yes, we did." And it's just end of discussion. And it's like so understood that like, oh, well, because, you know, an angry Black man, once he gets started, he's a killing machine and therefore you have to put him down. And like, they really lean into that. And I think with Bonnie, with like the, obviously the angry Black woman stereotype is has different stuff to it, but I think they tried to steer her away from that so much to the point where they maybe, I don't know, it's like they were trying to make us like her. They were like, oh, we can't have Bonnie object to too much because then people won't like that she's the angry Black woman.
Right. But it, because Bonnie's real cute. You can't have her be outspoken because then she's no longer the sidekick friend. She's the Black bitch and we don't want the Black bitch. Like, you don't want that. This idea that, but Caroline is allowed, I mean, Caroline.
Yes. To dissent,
like
all the time.
Like, I mean, at the, I was like, I do not like this girl, and it's okay. But people are still, you know, you don't have to like every character, but it doesn't take away from Bonnie's storyline. You know, she's the head cheerleader, all these other things. She becomes a vampire, all this rage, but then she develops into a more balanced character, right? Like, I don't know, they sort of tried to make Bonnie very muted. It wasn't.
Yeah. And it didn't make characterological sense for her because every time Bonnie has a strong point of view on something, and I will always go back to like when she pretends to dispel the anti-vampire device and doesn't.
Yep.
I loved that so much. That's like one of my very favorite things that she does. And she explains it to Caroline of being like, my Grams would never have done it. I couldn't do it. And it's like the most fascinating thing. And we just kind of lose that over time, and it feels like they hollow it out. It's almost like you're knocking on the wood of the, you know, the story, and then you get to Bonnie's and it's like, oh, this over here, this part is hollow. Like, they don't fill it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, part of it, it's a function of what happens to her, because she learns what happens anytime she does something that is for her best interest and that goes right. against someone else's best interest. It's this idea of know your place aggression. A term coined by Dr. Caretha Mitchell. And she basically describes it as what she calls it a flexible, dynamic array of forces that answer the achievements of marginalized groups such that their success brings aggression as often as praise. Any progress by those who are not straight, white, male is answered by a backlash of violence, both literal and symbolic, both physical and discursive, that essentially says, know your place. And so in Bonnie's case, right, we need a Bennett witch. We always need a Bennett witch. But despite the fact that she comes from this powerful family with significant right. abilities, that we always yes. need a Bennett witch. We always need a Bennett witch. We always need Bon Bon. She's consistently yep. marginalized and exploited by the white characters who seek to use yes. her for their own ends. And when she forgets her place, Ebony Elizabeth Thomas actually writes that she is judged as a killjoy and relegated right. to the margin of the narratives. And like, it's that, but also we know that Bonnie knows, like, she can't continue to have these little moments of resistance. Like, the right. the narrative doesn't allow for it, because the more she does, you've got Grams who dies. You know, she's got Dr. Martin yeah. and Luca, like all these people yeah. she's really connected to, they die. You know, her loving Enzo is an act of resistance against so many things. Mm. You know, she's punished routinely anytime yes. she sort of shows any agency. Yet and still, they need Bonnie. Like, yeah. they always need Bonnie. Even the ancestors punish her for bringing Jeremy back.
That's right. They abandon her.
They, you know, they leave her. And then, you know, she becomes an ancestor, or she becomes part of the anchor. Like,
that's right. Which is so painful. It only mm-hmm. brings her pain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, I wish that, because, and this is such a thing about like stories with witches or with vampires, there's so much like room for wish fulfillment in a way where it's like, oh, cool. Kind of the like cool part of being a superhero, like, oh, you get to have these awesome powers. And she doesn't get any of that. And even in a show where she does eventually get like a very interesting love interest, which is Enzo, she's still quite like sexless compared to a lot of the other females on the show. Like, and it's interesting because you wrote about Pearl Kleeges Just Want to Testify about the sisters in that undergoing sterilization as a part of a redemptive phase, which is so eugenics, yikes.
Yes.
And like has so many vibes that I don't know if I'm like overreading this, but it feels like they de-sexed Bonnie to the point where like, because they didn't, they were like, oh, don't want the angry black woman trope, don't want the Jezebel trope, we don't want to, it's like they just kind of cut off all these things because of, I don't know, just like,
well, and I'm not sure they were thinking about tropes. I'm thinking that they don't want to give Bonnie any sort of room for sympathy, any sort of humanity, right? So giving people an emotion, giving them a fulfilling sex life, right?
Yeah,
that's part of what makes people human. And so she can only be sad,
right?
She can only be, yeah, she's a device. She's sad, she's the best friend, but she better not get angry, we're gonna punish her. And she can't have sex because then her interest is gonna lie elsewhere,
right?
The idea that you've got divided loyalties, you're gonna
totally
you're gonna try to,
oh my god, she's so like subservient to Elena when she's like, I like your brother, oh no, what do you think, oh no, Jeremy, I can't do anything because you're Elena's brother. And it's like she's so overly, you know, concerned of what Elena thinks, she's not even allowed to have her own desire.
Yeah, and it's just like, I mean, it's Jeremy. Ugh.
Ugh. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I never understood why they shoehorned that in. Luca would have been the
so
best.
Ugh.
And they ended up on, like, they ended up working with Elijah anyway. And and that's, and I just don't understand. Anyway, okay, anyway, it's fine.
Yep. I'm gonna No, I mean, because it's aggravating. And I think too, even like, I mean, I don't know whether Kat Graham wanted to come back for the originals. Or even Legacies, but it is interesting that, I mean, she is mentioned in Legacies. Sometimes they'll say, oh, Aunt Bonnie, you know, they'll like make reference to, oh, she helped us come up with this. Yeah, of course she did, right? But there's, I don't know, no cameo, no real sort of mention. Yeah. And of course, I do think that the showrunners took some of the criticism to heart, because by the time we get to the originals, Like, of course, I loved, like, when I saw the preview for the first time, I was like, oh my God, there's a black vampire. And I was like, oh, he's gonna die. I just know it. Like, there, but I was like, you're not gonna show him as like the focal point of the preview if he's gonna die. Like, you're just not. But I was like, I also know how y'all do, so maybe you are. But when Vincent came on, so Vincent is the black male witch in the originals, and I was like, ooh, he was everything that Bonnie wasn't allowed to be. He is like, 'cause he's like, no. In the same way that Marcel is angry and rightfully so and assertive and all of that, so is Vincent. And he maintains that for most of the season. I mean, he does, as they all do, everybody's going to eventually start working for the Michelsons, but it's not just a sort of unquestioned loyalty. He definitely pushes back. And so it's one of the things that is really interesting. Like, because there were petitions about like stop killing all the black people on Vampire Diaries. And so by the time we get to the originals and even Legacies, there's a black vampire named Caleb on Legacies, and he tells the headmaster of the Salvatore school, because of course there's a Salvatore school for the gifted now. He's just like, you know what, Headmaster Saltzman, you need to let the witches use expression. You need to let the vampires drink human blood. You need to let the werewolves do what they do. He's like, because you're not helping them, you're hindering them. If you're not teaching the witches how to use expression, you're hindering them. And that's how I feel about Bonnie, right? She didn't really get, she got like on the job training, and then her grandmother dies, and her on the job training is, it's not learning how to light things, it's not, it's learning how to dispel witches, it's all these other things. And so, she's using her magic. Part of the issue with Bonnie that Bonnie faces is that she's using magic, not for her own benefit. She's using magic for other people. It's one of the reasons that I think magic is harmful to her, because it's supposed to be like, I mean, Vincent, he's like, magic is this, you take it from the earth, doing all these other things. And, the magic is harmful to her. And I think there's a larger lesson there. Like, anytime you're doing a craft for somebody else and at your own expense without being able to partake in the joy of it, it can be harmful, right? Whether that harm comes in the form of you resenting other people, workplace stress, sickness, and more. But for Bonnie, it manifests in a number of ways, losing people that she loves. But I don't know, like, the one thing that you hope for, like, magic is supposed to be sort of empowering, and it feels like it's anything but for Bonnie. Whereas in the other series connected to the Vampire Diaries, there seems to be the witches who use magic seem to have,
More of a reciprocity with their own power, hopefully. That's cool. That's good to hear that. I wonder, because it's interesting, because all of the vampires that you've talked about that are in this universe so far that are black are all men. Are there any female black vampires in.
Not major ones. Like, there's one who appears in the originals, but the person is killed off like 2 episodes later. I don't even think they have a name. So
Man.
no. And even what's interesting about the originals, well, even in the originals, like, a lot of the witches are white, which is such, not all of them, but a lot of them are white. I was like, oh, that's interesting. In Legacies, the two male vampires, there are two black male vampires. There is a black witch who shows up in season 3, who does have much more control of her magic than Bonnie does, which I do appreciate, but she still fits this similar pattern, which is part of the piece that I'm writing for Deanna's edited collection, sort of looking at what I'm calling the final blacks and how that's problematic.
Can we read Bonnie as vampiric in any way? I was thinking about some of the so some of the energy siphoning and stuff, with Shory and things like that. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we can read, 'cause Bonnie is obviously just a witch. She's never a vampire or a mix of both. Like, so is there anything about her that you can read as vampiric? Thinking about a lot of the themes that you touched on in She Bites Back.
I mean, I would say, I mean, I guess you could read it like that, because I don't. I mean, yes, so in Mind of My Mind, I was making that comparison, because one of the characters is actually described as a vampire twice, even though she's a human. And so it was the author's intentional use of the term that made me sort of extrapolate that for the text. And so some of the language and things, the language of vampirism, I felt like was present in Mind of My Mind. But in this instance, I wouldn't call Bonnie vampiric. But of course, you know, she does, I mean, but the language is also there. So like you've got the heretics who are hybrid witch vampires who can drink blood and siphon magic from your skin. So, you know, Bonnie can desiccate a vampire by siphoning them. So can the twins, the baby twins, Caroline, the kids that Caroline births but aren't her biological kids, those they siphon. And so, but I wouldn't call it vampiric in the traditional sense. But she's certainly dangerous, and I think that people realize that. But yeah, I wouldn't call it vampiric in the same way that I'm thinking about it with Mind of My Mind. But
That
if
makes a
somebody
lot of
made, like,
sense.
if a student of mine or anybody wrote the argument, I'd be like,
Yeah,
I'm down.
I'd
Like,
read
I wouldn't
that.
call it that, but I, yeah, that's.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah, going back to our blackmail vampires in the Vampire Diaries, we have a very interesting season one character named Harper, who he comes out and he's straight from Civil War times. Like, and everything that we see about him is like it's interesting because you know there's the mammy stereotype, which I don't really see too much in Bonnie, but I saw it very much in Harper, strangely, where he's sort of subservient or, you know, to Anna's mom, who is Pearl. Am I right to think that that's happening there, or are there threads there, or is that kind of, am I missing something on that theme?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, it's a gender term. And so because he's male, I wouldn't call him
Got
that.
it.
He's more of what we call the subservient, docile, the uncle stereotype, or the
Oh, okay.
magical Negro or a sacrificial
Sure.
Negro. So always
Yes.
indifference to whiteness, always helping. So similar, but just there's a different term for it.
Yeah, that makes
But
sense. It's
yeah.
interesting because he ties very much into like the way that the Vampire Diaries uses flashbacks to different times, and they just so like once again, it's like so whitewashed. It's so whatever it is that they need for their protagonists. There's never a question of like what it must have been like for certain folks living that time, you
Not at
know,
all.
at all. And yeah, it's
Not at
gosh,
all.
I'm
Well,
like
and also he's mute, isn't he? Like he doesn't speak.
Harper?
Yeah, does he
No,
speak?
he speaks.
But okay, I don't
You'd
remember.
think he's mute, huh? Yeah, it's
Yeah, because I
no.
was just like,
He's just like overly polite, and there's no sense of like
okay.
because it's almost like time travel. Like when he comes out of that tomb, I mean, he went in there middle of the Civil War,
Yeah.
comes out in like 2009, and there's no like adjustment understanding of like looking around at the town, looking at, like a place that he literally just was 200 years ago. There's nothing. He just kind of is like, I'm gonna borrow this nice hiker's clothes, and I'm gonna. There's nothing about it, which is classic. Yeah, I guess we talked a little bit about why Bonnie's arc, especially the ending, is unsatisfying, but do you have anything else about that? I just wanted to make sure I touched on that so that we could talk about it. We did talk about it.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, I don't know how else to say. Like, it was deeply unsatisfying. It's been good to see her in different roles outside of that, where she is, you know, she gets to be, you know, she's done a couple of Netflix movies. She was also a character on, she was a side character on the movie version of Addicted. Addicted is a erotic novel by Zane, a Black woman writer, and I think Tyler Perry adapted it into a movie. And Bonnie's character is, again, she's a side character, but she ends up sleeping with somebody else's like side boo. And in a house where the woman is, and I was like, oh, Bonnie, up on the wall, like, oh, hey, girl, wow. I was like, what in the world? But it was not in a bad way, but it was like, oh, okay, hey, Bonnie. But it was just sort of nice to see her like doing something different. Like, y'all could have had, you know, I guess a less spicy version of that on The Vampire Diaries. Although The Vampire Diaries, there was lots of sex. Like, it wasn't so, you know, it may, you know, it may have been like PG sex. I don't feel like we saw like nipples and things, but there was no question about what was happening.
Is there anything that you think that we can learn from Bonnie as a character? Even with all the writing problems, there are a lot of things that I love about her. Like, she has this beautiful self-assuredness at times and can know her boundaries. And I just wonder if there's anything that you take from her that you really cherish.
Yeah, I mean, she is a good friend, right? And so, like, you know, I think we can, it's nice to have good, reliable friends. So I'm sorry, I feel like I'm, was it Aretha Franklin who was asked about Taylor Swift? And she was like, gowns, beautiful gowns. Like, that's who, like, that's, like, and it's like, it, cause it's, so yes, like, I mean, I think Bonnie is a good friend. I love the season when she became the Huntress, because she's like, I've got to kill you. You know, she's a good problem solver.
Yes.
You know, I love when she found moments of connection. She was always trying to connect with people who,
yes,
like, she was like, oh my gosh, you're just like me, or oh my God, like, yes, stuff like that. So, like, she was searching for intentional community that would have bolstered her, even though it didn't, yes, really seem to serve her. And so I like that she was, I mean, I like that she was always hungry, but I guess she was always put in that position.
Right. We hate that she had to be hungry.
Yeah, I hate that she had to be hungry. And then there were moments where there, like there are moments where she has agency, where she's like, no, this is what I'm going to do. You know, doing, like, going out on a lamb, doing her own thing. But it's really hard. I'm just like, gowns, beautiful gowns. Cause it's so,
gowns, beautiful.
Like, cause gowns. Yeah, it's like, I'm like rooting for Bonnie, wanting all the best for her. But
yes. It's hard to extricate her from the, like, baked in white supremacy of the,
and it's just sad.
It is. Well, let's end on a good note. Are there any suggested reading or watching things that you want to leave us with? I mean, you've mentioned a lot of awesome stuff, but
I mean, you've already mentioned Ebony Elizabeth Thomas's The Dark Fantastic Race and the Imagination from Harry Potter to the Hunger Games, which I absolutely recommend. Caretha Mitchell's Identifying White Mediocrity and Know Your Place Aggression, A Form of Self-Care. I think that's a really good text to read as well. If you're into, like, genre studies, I think that if you want to, like, anybody wants to learn more about, like, Black horror, I think Robin Armin's Coleman's Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films, which is a 2011 book, but there was a documentary called Horror Noir that came out, I want to say, like, 2019, 2020, so I think that would be a good one to watch. But also, just last year in 2023, Means Coleman and Mark H. Harris also wrote this book called The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar. So I think that would be a good book to read. And then there are a couple of articles that I think are really interesting, but one that sticks out to me the most is by Rebecca Lush. She wrote Original Sin, Frontier Horror, Gothic Anxiety, and Colonial Monsters in the Vampire Diaries.
Ooh. Oh my God.
I thought that was really good. And then there's another one, I'm forgetting her last name. I think it's, like, Jewett. But what she writes about is how the Michelsons imagine themselves as the original Indigenous Americans, and at the same time displace the Indigenous Americans who were there. So they see themselves, she's like, they position themselves as both victims and perpetrators. And I was like, oh, that was really interesting.
Well said.
Yeah, so I like that. That's awesome. Yeah.
I knew you would not disappoint. I was like,
I'm just like, I mean, if you're just looking for, like, Black vampire stuff to read, if you want a really good novel, Brandon Massey's Dark Corner was published in 2014 and then republished in 2017. It's a great novel. Oh my gosh. I teach it to my students.
Awesome.
My mom has read it a couple of times. She was like, I want to take your class. I was like, okay, I'll just send you some videos from it.
I love that.
And so she read it alongside my students. It's such a good book. My students are always awesome.
That's great. We do something non-Vampire Diaries every year for April Fools. And so maybe Dark Corner will have to be.
It's a good one.
Awesome.
There was a question you asked me. It was about, it's an interesting thing to be able to hold a love for Bonnie and the deep disappointment. But you said, how does the way Bonnie was written represent white anxieties about Black female power? I did have something to say. I don't know if you want to add it in there.
Yes. I knew I was missing something. I was like, okay. Okay, yes.
Okay, so
Yeah.
in terms of genre, Bonnie, I said, Bonnie falls prey to the depiction of Black women in horror, where Black women have
Yes.
often been the spiritual guide or the sacrifice, which is something that Tananarive Due comments on in her foreword to this new anthology called "The Black Girl Survives in This One," that came out in 2024, and so it speaks to the larger trope of the sacrificial Negro, which isn't limited to the horror genre,
Right.
but it also speaks to the magical Negro trope if we think about movies like Ghost with Whoopi Goldberg, Demi Moore, and Patrick Swayze. But more broadly, Bonnie isn't allowed to be the center of attention or desired love interest, right? We know that she's not just the Black best friend, but when she steps out of line, which means refusing to do any bidding for whiteness, she is sort of depicted as the angry Black girl or the jealous, bitchy Black friend. And so, and then of course, when she does agree to help white people, sacrifices come with death, bodily harm, loss of magic, and her sacrifice is actually something that's expected, not something that's considered remarkable. It's not like, oh my God, thank you so much for sacrificing. It's like, good job, Bon Bon. Thanks for sacrificing.
Thanks for sacrificing your grams. Thanks for sacrificing your mom. Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, your mom.
Yourself.
Everybody, thanks so much. But you're supposed
High
to. It's
five.
more like high five. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I can't wait to read your final Blacks essay. That's
Yeah.
amazing. I'm gonna put it hopefully in the show notes, like if we ever, I think it's slated for like 2026 or no, 2025, something
Something
in the
I
years
don't
to
know. Yeah,
come.
in a couple of years, probably.
Whenever it becomes available, I will put it in the show notes as well as how to get your current works.
Yes.
She Bites Back was such an amazing. I've like marked up my entire copy. My roommate walked in on me reading it, and she went, "Oh, you're one of those people that writes in books." And I was like, "It's a sign of respect."
That's the only type of person to be. No, it's the only type of person to be, honestly. But
Well, how can people find you and your work? Do you want me to put your website here or?
so yeah, if folks want to get in contact with me, they could just go to my website. There's a contact form there. It's www.kendrarparker.com. You can access some of my work there, see about some of the classes I teach, and there's a link to, get in touch with me through the contact form.
Rock on. Thank you so much for your time and energy on this. And maybe I'll have you back on for Dark Quarter. That would be very cool to do
Ooh, I would love
that.
it.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank
Yay.
you.